The first human societies of which we have any reliable and detailed record are Babylon and Egypt. It so happens that these two vast and splendid achievements of the genius of ancients bear witness against two of the commonest and crudest assumptions of the culture of the moderns. If we want to get rid of half of the nonsense about nomads and cavemen and the old man of the forest, we need only to look steadily at the two solid and stupendous facts called Egypt and Babylon. Welcome to Pints with Chesterton, a podcast where two millennial women dive into the wonderful and whimsical works of Gilbert Keith Chesterton. I'm Marie.
And I'm Grace. On today's episode, we are discussing Chapter 3 of The Everlasting Man, The Antiquity of Civilization. Marie.
Hello.
Hello.
Everybody should be proud of us. We're back.
Yeah. 2 weeks later.
Yeah. Instead of 1 week later. No, it's only been a week.
Oh, yeah. Has it only been a week? Oh, I guess I'm just forgetting all the times we had to re-record that.
We recorded over 3 weeks, but we have been here. We've been showing up. Grace, I'm drinking an old-fashioned again tonight.
I mean, when you find something good, you know.
I've decided, though, I'm gonna change it up again next week. But tonight, it sounded good again, so here we are. What have you been up to this week?
This week, we kind of wrapped up the semester. I'm just sort of like looking back over everything at work. And so I've, just kind of been in transition mode, I think, from the school year to the summer, which has been good. It's, it is always a little bit of a transition.
Yeah.
So I'm, looking forward to a lot of good reading time and reflection time this summer while I don't have as many programs and things throughout the week. So
that's awesome.
For sure. I'd have to learn over the years, though, to be, I guess, gentle with myself as the transitions happen between the seasons, because I think you can get such in a rhythm and then it's like all of a sudden, oh, this is different.
Yeah.
And I like my old routines are not working and I have to establish new ones. So, yeah,
I've been spending a lot of time outside in this beautiful weather and it's honestly been really hard to get all of like my housework and reading and everything that I need to get done because I just want to be outside when it's nice.
That's awesome. Yes. I relate to that.
And my kids want to be outside too, so we've been doing a lot more of that, and I've just, you know, it's like the floors haven't gotten mopped as much and nobody cares, so everybody's happy.
That's good.
I haven't had a lot of free time for reading lately, but I've been reading Howard's End by E.M. Forster.
Isn't there a did they make a show about that?
I don't know if there's a show, but there's a movie. Certainly.
Yeah. A movie. Maybe that's what it is.
And I actually watched the movie with David, I don't know, in the last few years and really liked it. But what is it? What is that podcast called? The Literary Life podcast went through Howard's End and it made me really want to read it. So I'm reading it, enjoying it very much. It has sucked me in immediately. And
cool.
Honestly, so far it's very similar to the film. I mean, they seem to be following the text closely in the film. So have you been reading anything this week, more scripture or anything else?
Actually, I've been doing a lot of reading for work, so it hasn't been fiction or even really a whole lot of scripture just besides prayer. But our staff does formation every week. And so right now we're working through Evangelii Nuntiandi, which is a document on evangelization from Paul the Sixth, I think. And it's kind of a staple and a classic. And so we're reading it. But also we have here at our campus a whole bunch of Focus missionaries, and I think we do really well as compared to other places I've heard about, but just kind of integrating both our campus ministry and the Focus mission together. But there's always room for improvement and things like that. And so I have been reading the Focus Blue Book, which is like their little manual that they have for all the missionaries and like how they like
sounds so Mormon.
How they lead people through I know right little book. Lead people yeah. through like this kind of like path of like learning how to be a disciple okay. of Jesus. And it's actually very good. There's a lot of awesome yeah, helpful things, very practical things in there. And I'm seeing a lot of overlap between what I had naturally been doing, just teaching RCIA or like, yeah, leading students through formation. So anyway, I'm doing a lot of like synthesizing of information and trying to see like where there are like some discrepancies or maybe some misunderstandings or just like how we use different lingo about the same things and like how does all that work together. Mm. And so anyways, it's been really good. It's been really, really fascinating.
That's good.
Just kind of been working on those things recently. So I haven't really been reading as much for pleasure, although I do find it pleasurable.
That's good. am I remembering correctly that you went to go do some sort of focus training or you like at least got to observe or something?
I am about to. I'm going to go in June. Okay, they have their summer training for their missionaries every year and they invite campus ministers of focus campuses to come and kind of have like a couple of days. And I honestly don't know what it's going to look like. I don't know if we're going to get to observe things or if there's going to be other. I know we're going to have opportunity to meet with our missionaries that are coming on our campus in the fall, which it's great that we really don't have a whole lot of turnover at our campus. We retain a lot of our missionaries for a long time, which is unusual.
It sounds like everybody likes to work where you work, though.
Yeah.
It sounds like apparently such a fabulous staff.
I've heard that among Focus, everybody talks about LSU.
everybody wants to come to LSU. That's
so
cool.
I understand why. I feel extremely blessed to be here on this staff full time. It's a special place for sure.
Yeah. That's awesome. Well, good. Well, everybody, we're jumping into chapter 3 of The Everlasting Man today, and I have to express kind of frustration. I read this chapter so many times and I was slogging through it.
Yeah, I felt that too.
It felt very redundant in a lot of places. I'm going to admit it. I found this to be one of the more frustrating chapters of the whole book.
Yeah.
So if you felt like that when you were reading through this, just
solidarity.
You're not alone. And actually, I found the Dale's commentary on this very helpful because he says in his commentary that even Chesterton said he wasn't satisfied with how this chapter turned out. So
I can see that.
As I said, it's very redundant in the first, 10 or so pages of the chapter. He talks about the same thing again, how we really can't know anything about prehistory because it's before history, before narratives that we can understand and talk about and study. And he really just pounds that home again. Grace, did you feel like that too?
Yeah, I definitely did. I definitely felt like he was just like repeating it again and again and again. There were a couple of points from the beginning pages of the chapter that I thought might be good to talk about a little bit that I found, interesting and true. One of the first things was I thought about, have you ever read the novel or the, I guess, group of novellas, The A Canticle for Leibowitz?
No, but I have heard of that.
So in that story, there's three novellas or like three parts of the book. And the premise is that at 600 years before the book begins, there's some sort of catastrophic event that kills off a lot of the population of the planet. But there's surviving people. And so the people who survive have to kind of like rebuild civilization. So the first novella is 600 years after the catastrophic event. The next novella takes place 600 years after that. And then the third one takes place 600 years after that.
Interesting.
And so it's following one monastery that is kind of tracked through the whole time. And there's lots of different characters and things. But anyways, it reminded me when I was reading this, the first part of the chapter reminded me of this idea of Canticle for Leibowitz, because in that book, the catastrophic event that happens in the book happens in like the 1970s.
Okay.
So this is all like in the future, like beyond where we are today. Yeah. And you can start to see patterns emerge of like what happened, you know, in the last 2000 years of our history in like the next 2000 years in this in this novel. And you can kind of see certain things. Was it Mark Twain that said that like history doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme? Where it's you can kind of see like similarities or things starting to like repeat. So I think in this chapter, Chesterton's talking about how like we tend to think, or maybe the scientists or whoever he's talking about, or sociologists or whoever, are saying like, oh, like we're progressing as a society, or we're like going forward. But like Chesterton is saying, like, actually it's more like rise and fall of civilizations. And there's like kind of this cyclical nature of how things happen. And that's because there's like these two things that are kind of existing side by side instead of progressing one from the other. And what did he say? There were two words that he used.
Are you talking about, oh, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I just found it. It's barbarism and civilization.
Right.
Yeah. So basically he's saying like those two things, it's not as if there was one and then the other, like one for a time and then the other for the rest of time. It's that both of those things are happening like simultaneously, but also kind of flowing in and out of each other for all of history. And I found that to be very true. But also just like enlightening, even just like on a personal spiritual level, that like inside of us, there is like goodness and evil. And like, we are constantly kind of like progressing in and out of those things, like in our own daily lives. So I don't know. I found that to be kind of a relatable thing. And he also talks about like democracy and despotism too, like and I thought that was really, what did you think about him saying kind of like the relationship between experience and exhaustion, where he kind of claimed that like in the beginning there's this like burst of energy and like a democracy can happen,
thrrive and
and then people get tired. And they're like, well, we're just going to put one guy in charge because it's easier and we're tired. Yeah. You know, I was like, wow, that's super interesting. I don't know. I could relate to that on a human level.
I totally agree. And I liked that he made the point that tyranny often doesn't happen at the beginning of a society. Mm-hmm. It happens at the end.
Yeah.
It happens when it's coming to a downfall. And we can see that in just like the last 200 years. If we look at like, for example, Germany and everything that happened in Germany with Hitler and his party taking over power in Germany and then becoming very tyrannical and genocidal. And then its downfall, right? After quite a short period of time. So I feel like there are plenty of modern examples of this example that he's giving, but then he gives us Egypt and Babylon as something very concrete to look at from antiquity, which is very useful.
Totally.
One of the things that I liked that he talked about was he said that Egypt was more artistic and Babylon was more philosophic. And he basically talks about how history of Babylon in particular was just basically a record of all of the times that nomads or barbarians tried to destroy it and like how well it stood up to that. And it's just interesting to me thinking about these two societies, both near the Mediterranean. And he has his whole rant in this later in this chapter about the Mediterranean and how everything that's important has happened around the Mediterranean, culture, philosophy,
super interesting.
Jesus. But these two societies, civilizations, not in dissimilar parts of the world, but with very different sort of cultures and ways of communicating. And I don't know, I loved what he said about Egyptians and hieroglyphics developing. And I just thought he's just so cute and funny about everything. Maybe I shouldn't be calling him cute, but he is. He's just...
No, he's definitely cute.
I liked... He said he like describes a pharaoh with all of his guys around him. And they're like sending a message up the river. And they're being really silly with it, like with the pictures that they're sending to mean something. And anyway,
that was,
and then
funny.
He talks about Babylon being more of a civilization of diagrams and philosophy, and like sort of less artistic, less lighthearted, it seems. It gives us a view into what the world was in antiquity, which is really important to understand.
Yeah. I think it's really fascinating, just like those two pictures of humanity, like the more artsy and the more, I don't know, you could call like it like engineering brain or something like that, you know. Mm-hmm. You can kind of see these like forms,
I had the same
like
thought. Yeah.
Throughout the rest of history. Yeah. And it's so funny because that's the whole conversation that we've been having on our staff recently, is like the relationship between the science and the art of evangelization and teaching the faith. Mm-hmm. And how there has to be like both. So there's like these two things held in tension, and maybe when one's extreme or the other's extreme, there's something missing.
Yeah, totally. Something that was interesting that I thought maybe we could talk about a little bit was, he touches on the fact that Babylon is thought to have had sort of, he says, I'm going to just read this sentence. It says, it is said that they had much of the modern cult of the higher spinsterhood and recognized an official class of independent working women. And he
scary.
Kind of, you know, he's obviously thinking about like modern feminism, which was like starting to kind of rear its head in Chesterton's life. Mm-hmm. As women who have both worked.
Yeah.
I'm not trashing working.
Yeah, I was
but,
about to say me who currently works. Yeah.
Yes, you currently work. Yeah. What were your thoughts on kind of why that could be a negative thing to have this class of independent working women?
Yeah, I mean, I think for Chesterton, it's just kind of a part of his like larger understanding of society. And like, I think for him, it's not so much the issue of like a woman working, but maybe just the idea that work outside the home is glorified to this extent that it's like what everybody should want to do or something like that, or somehow women are less for staying at home. You know, I think Chesterton is like maybe reacting against that notion whenever he talks about feminism, which like in our society today, like the way Chesterton talks about it sometimes can sound like offensive, you know, or something like that. But I kind of wonder if it's really like how I feel like Chesterton does this in everything, where he just like he overemphasizes a point to make a point, you know, or he like kind of hyperbolizes something in order to bring out a truth that's maybe being missed. And so that's kind of how I feel about anytime he talks about feminism and things like that. But I don't know. Did you have another thought?
I thought that the evil about it was that it's working, independent working women at the exclusion of them being a wife and a mother. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I can see that too. Yeah.
Okay. They're working, but they also get the joy and fulfillment of, you know, being a wife or a mother. That's one thing. But to work at the, you know, instead of being open to like the huge gift that it is, that, you know, that our bodies are for bearing children and things like that. I think he probably had a problem with that, because work is great and it is meaningful and it is our vocation at times, but it's definitely something very supernatural to bring another soul into existence.
Oh yeah. And I think that's why he's kind of reacting against this notion that like work is like the over glorification of work as something that is like the pinnacle of like what we should strive for as human beings. And if we aren't doing that, or we can't do that because we have to stay home with our kids, you know, or something like that, like we have to stay home with our kids, as if that's like something bad. I think that's what he's like reacting against. And so this idea of like, oh, I'm only like a strong and independent and liberated and free woman if I can like throw off the shackles of family life and be able to do what all the men do. And it's sort of like, well, obviously Chesterton thinks that's wrong. So him kind of like pointing that out as like, maybe this isn't the best idea to like have this like something to aspire to, I guess, for like all women, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, it is really interesting. I would love for him to see feminism today and hear him debate with a modern feminist.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think I'm convinced that he would take different approaches. Like, I think he was very much a man of his time, and like, I think that if he lived, this is just a hot take, but I think if he lived today, he would definitely approach it in a different way than he did then. But
I think
still making the same philosophy or whatever, same point.
Yeah, I think he definitely would. I think one of his gifts was that he understood how to talk to people,
mm-hmm.
and to like best address his audience. Mm-hmm. Or whoever he was speaking with, but also just to be himself and to be really clear and not clear at the same time.
Yeah, kind of like like I was saying, hyperbole in order to like emphasize a point, you know?
Yeah. The next thing that, so honestly, I've read this through several times and I kept saying to David, I don't understand why this chapter is important. And then I was reading it again today and I read this about slavery, and basically he's talking about how slavery was already hard at work in these early civilizations. He says, in one sense, there is a significance in the old slavery. It stands for one fundamental fact about all antiquity before Christ, something to be assumed from first to last. It is the insignificance of the individual before the state. It is one of the signs of this spirit that a whole class of individuals could be insignificant or invisible. This struck me, oh my gosh, to the heart.
Yeah.
Because I truly believe that Christ loves and sees each one of us so intimately and so individually.
Mm-hmm.
And to think of a society that just as a whole basically didn't see an entire class of people as people, or, you know, as individuals. But yeah, I thought this was maybe the whole point of the chapter. I maybe should have made it the quote at the beginning, but that Christ radically transformed a world that didn't see dignity in people, really.
Yeah.
This is crazy, right?
Yeah. No, yeah, I think that's huge. And I think, like, kind of what we were talking about earlier, where there's like in societies and this almost like cyclical nature, like there's always this like decline and this fall of civilizations and then a rise of civilizations and a fall. Mm-hmm. Just like within us, there's like maybe the rise of virtue and then maybe fall. And then maybe, you know, like we have this sin that we're struggling against, even just like within our own hearts and our own lives. And we cannot, no matter how good of a society we can build, no matter like how hard we try on our own, like as human beings, like either individually or as a society, like we cannot overcome this war between those, that good and evil, basically. And only Christ can come and liberate us from that evil. And so just this kind of painting that picture of like, even in the beginning there was this slavery, it's almost like there's the real fact of slavery, or like the experience of slavery, and then that as like a metaphor or like an image or an icon of our own experience as human beings, like with sin and death and darkness, that Christ comes to liberate us from. And there is no change until Christ enters the picture.
Grace, you're so right. He's the only one who changes it for us. Because how many years of human beings happened before he came, and we don't even know what prehistory looks like, as mm-hmm. Chesterton comments so many times.
Yeah he even says like that, he uses the phrase about like the old man or something like that, I think from H.G. Wells, and he's saying like that implies that the prehistory, like the civilization was old already, like that it had been for a long time, which I thought was really interesting to think about too.
Yeah, totally. That made this whole chapter worth it for me. I was like, okay, this was worth reflecting on. This is what he's really trying to paint this picture for us of like what the world, how the world was suffering before mm-hmm. Christ came. Because, you know, why does it matter if Christ came if the world wasn't that in you know, in a state. But he's saying, like, even with these civilizations who had plenty of evils about them, but, you know, lots of good things too, and they showed progress. Mm-hmm. And I'm putting air quotes, like, they they had progress, they had, you know, scientific mechanisms that were impressive for their time or whatnot, but none of that matters if you're a slave to sin,
right? Yeah, it's like there's certain ways that we progress. I think it is true that, like, if you're looking at history, like, through the eyes of God, and you're seeing, like, oh, okay, like, from the beginning until the end of time, like, there is this sort of progression of, like, how God will bring all things to completion. Like, there is, like, a healing, and there is, like, a changing, and there is a drawing closer to the heart of God that, like, he wants to do, and he is doing, mm-hmm. throughout all of history. So in some sense, there is a progression. And even just, like, in our, yeah, like, I don't know, our understanding of the human person or whatever, like, in some ways we progress, but in other ways we don't. In other ways we regress. In other ways we fall. In other ways we go right back to the beginning of, you yeah. know, enslaving people and doing things that are heinous crimes against humanity, you know? Yes. And yeah, so I mean, you can talk about, like, primitive, you know, primitive civilizations or being, like, barbarians or whatever, but then you see what the Nazis did, like you said earlier, in Germany, and it's like, holy cow, like, how primitive is that? Like,
and that
you
was
know,
so recent. Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's just, I think we just oversimplify. I think we do this all the time, just, like, oversimplify history and how it works by saying, or by seeing it as linear, seeing it just yes. as progressive.
Yes.
Yeah. And even in our personal lives, right? Like,
yeah.
Our
There's
own
lots
even
of
just like
taking 14 steps back or to the right. side and then trying to progress forward again.
Exactly. I remember listening to Father John Ricardo talk one time, and he was talking about, like, this kind of progression of, like, the spiritual life, and, like, there's, like, point A and then point B and then point C. And he's like, guys, like, I've never left point A. Like, I'm still in, like, even if I've progressed in some ways to point C, like, I'm still at point A. Like, it's like, it's not this linear thing, you know?
So. Oh, yeah. It would be simpler if it were. Okay, so then he said something that when I first read it, I was like, what? This felt very controversial to me. He says about the Mediterranean, it was the world of war and peace, the world of good and evil, the world of all that matters most. And with all respect to the Aztecs and the Mongols of the Far East, they did not matter as the Mediterranean tradition mattered and still matters. And he goes on to say that if those other cultures had never existed and only what happened around the Mediterranean, philosophy, culture, and Jesus, if that was all that existed, that was all that really matters to our world today. Mm. And I was like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
What?
That's pretty controversial.
It's a strong, it's definitely expressing something strong.
Yeah.
What did you think about that?
I mean, I think I had the same reaction when I first read it as you, just being like, woo, I don't know about that. But, you know, I thought about it a little bit, and I think, again, with Chesterton, so many things, he likes the shock factor, you know, of, like, saying something that's like, ooh, to kind of bring up a point. And I mean, in some sense, and maybe this is just because I am a Western person who has been raised in, you know, Western culture and things like that. But I feel like the philosophies, the ideas, the history that seems to have affected even those places now where the Aztecs came from and where the yes. Mongols came from and whatever has been largely influenced by what happened around the Mediterranean. So I don't think on one level you could really argue
wrong.
With it. Yeah. But in another sense, I mean, it could definitely be, if, again, I'll say this 5 million times, like, with all things Chesterton, he's kind of going overboard and over to make a certain point. Like, I don't think yeah. he's trying to say that there's nothing important in these other cultures. I don't think right. he's trying to say that there's nothing beautiful or nothing worth
or
saving. You know what I mean?
Have existed.
Yeah,
or
like
yeah.
that. I think you have to kind of take him with a grain of salt. I tell people this all the time when they talk, students and different people start asking me, like, oh, I'd like to read some Chesterton. I've never read him, whatever. I'm like, okay, read. We'll talk about what may be best for you to start reading. But first, you need to understand this about Chesterton. Chesterton by training and even by trade is not a philosopher and a theologian. He's a journalist and an artist. And so I feel like you have to remember that the way he makes very good, very philosophical and sometimes theological points is not by doing Thomistic, you know, like proofs or whatever.
Yeah.
It's by painting a picture with words, you know, and he's not precise. He's very over the top in a lot of things that he says. And I think even just like, for example, Man Alive, we talked about that at the beginning of this book because he references it at the beginning of this book in the introduction. Yeah. But yeah, just like the whole journey of Innocent Smith, like around the world, you know, it's sort of like, it's over the top, you know, it's like nobody's going to actually do that in order to make sure that they love their wife well, you know. But he's making a point that's very real and very valid, you know. And so I think in all things Chesterton, you kind of have to like say, okay, what is the point he's trying to make here, and like, is it something that maybe I've never considered before, you know, something that is going to make me think a little bit, and it may have some shock value to it in order to get me to think about it in a way that I've never thought about it before. But but I think if you read him too seriously, then you can get into some trouble.
I like the distinction that you made about he's not saying that nothing good or nothing worth knowing about has ever happened in these places. But I have to admit, as I reflected on it more and my own education, the importance of philosophy and the importance of basically everything that the Greeks and Romans did for us. I realized that the one thing that they had in common with Christ, even before Christ and as pagans, was that they were seeking truth and they were seeking beauty and wisdom, and truth and beauty and wisdom are of God. So even if pagans seek truth, wisdom, beauty, they'll find God in at least in some way or to some extent. Which is why a culture that emphasizes seeking those things and cultivating asking the sorts of questions where you're going to find the truth is the perfect place to accept Christ or for Christ to come to. And I'm like a little bit biased because I'm Lebanese and, you know, from near the Mediterranean. So
I had Lebanese before I came here tonight to record this. And I thought of you.
I love it. I love it. I think he takes a long time to get going in this chapter. And then at the end, he starts kind of hitting on these very important. He's finally explaining to us, like, why have I been saying any of the things that I'm saying about history? And it's because pagans and religious people leading up into the up to this point all played this very important role to lead us to Christ. And Christ came to save a very barbaric world. Civilizations and barbarians alike, whatever, but we were all barbarians basically before him.
And we remain barbarians after him if we haven't yet fully accepted him and come to know it. You know what I mean?
One last interesting thing that I don't think is crucially important to coming discussion, but he kind of touches on like race and calling people by race. Another transformation that came after Christ is that, you know, I don't introduce myself to people and say like, "Hi, I'm Marie. I'm Lebanese, Irish American." I say, "Hi, I'm a Catholic or I'm a Christian." That is my new identity. And if the color of me matters to you, it shouldn't, because my culture is Christian.
Yeah.
Like my culture is Christ.
Yeah, there's just there's something that's like a deeper. It's like all these things can be part of our identity, but there's a deeper identity, and like the true identity that all of us are meant to share is that I'm a son or daughter of God. And that's something that he makes possible, Christ. And before that, there's just so much cause for division. But in Christ, like, there's this great cause of unity that is impossible without him.
Also, something useful is like, after we were released these each week, The Chesterton Society releases theirs the next week or 2 weeks after. So if there's something that we kind of don't answer for you, or, you know, you still feel confused, go listen over there at Chesterton.org. They're different people, so they'll be covering things that they noticed in the chapter, and, you know, you may...
Different aspects of also things. And
more scholarly than us, so...
Yeah, we've said from the very beginning, we're not scholars, we're just enthusiasts
hanging out.
We're normal people, and we just want other people to love Chesterton like we do. So
he's so good.
That's why we're doing this.
Grace, what are you grateful for this week?
I am really grateful for the people that I work with. I feel like I say that a lot, but I'm also just grateful for the transition into the summer months and just an opportunity to kind of like reflect and rest and pray and read and just kind of enter into a new mode of being and living for the next two or three months.
I am grateful for my garden and my backyard right now, and just the beauty around me every day, and just seeing things growing and sort of like you being renewed in a way by this season. And just for lots of worthy projects in my life right now that I feel they challenge me, but they're very good for me, and so I'm grateful for that too.
That's good.
Okay, well, we'll see you guys next week. You can find us at pintswithchesterton.com, or you can email us at pintswithchesterton@gmail.com. We hope you all enjoy lives of wit
and whimsy.
Cheers.